Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the impromptu summit underway in Paris between Secretary of State Kerry and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, which was initiated by a phone call on Friday from Russia's President Putin to President Obama. Former Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, the president of the Brookings Institution, joins us to examine the meaning behind Lavrov's call for neutrality in Ukraine and a new constitution providing for a federal structure, and whether his pledge that we have absolutely no intent or interest in crossing Ukraine's border ends speculation about the next move of the battle-ready Russian army massed on the border. We'll also look into the issue of Transnistria the Russians have raised, which could be the next flashpoint. Then John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus, where he has an article, Brown is the New Black in Russia, joins us to discuss the continuing insistence by Putin and Lavrov that fascists and anti-Semites have taken power in Ukraine and that its new government consists of armed radicals. We'll look into whether the pot is calling the kettle black, given the extent to which ugly right-wing nationalism bubbles beneath the surface in Russia. Then finally, we'll examine an emerging Republican strategy to limit Democratic votes in pivotal swing states in the upcoming midterm election. A nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation, Richard Hassan, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, joins us to discuss the lead article in Sunday's New York Times, New GOP Bid to Limit Voting in Swing States, and new bills, laws, and administrative rules in Ohio, Wisconsin, and North Carolina aimed at suppressing the Democratic vote that might inspire Democrats to turn out in November. And joining us now is Strobe Talbot, who's the president of the Brookings Institution and a former deputy secretary of state in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Strobe Talbot.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you.
And at this point, Secretary of State John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov are in a meeting. The only thing that we've heard from is the photo op on the steps as they went in, where Lavrov cryptically added in English as Kerry said goodbye to the press, good luck and good night. Edward R. Murrow, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure it was cryptic. Maybe it was just a wisecrack.
Yeah. So what have you heard anything about what might be going on inside that meetings at the Russian embassy in Paris?
Well, nothing that surprises. And it's actually pretty clear what's going on. And it's a square off between the United States and Russia on a key question, which is Russia going to allow Ukraine to continue to develop as a truly independent sovereign nation? Or is President Putin going to use the leverage that he already has as a result of having annexed Crimea, which was sovereign Ukrainian territory until all of a sudden it wasn't and became reattached to the Russian Federation, as well as many other levers that he has to put pressure on the Ukrainians. And the United States' goal here is to reinforce the ability of a provisional government, which took the place of a brutal and corrupt dictator whom the Ukrainian people basically drove out of office. There's some quite solid technocrats, moderates who are in charge now, and then there's going to be an election in May. And that election will put in place a new government, and the United States' goal is to make sure that that new government will be able to act as a sovereign government of an independent country.
Well, Strobe Talbot, up until this point, with this Friday phone call and the subsequent pledge by Lavrov that we have absolutely no interest or intent or interest in crossing Ukraine's border, prior to that, there was a sense of alarm. There was reports from the Pentagon suggesting that this was a serious invasion force, if you will. I spoke about a week ago with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer in Moscow, who's the independent defense analyst with Novaya Gazeta. And he was convinced that Putin was riding high in the polls. He was drunk with power. and that he couldn't allow this election that you just mentioned on May the 25th to go forth, and that he would invade. So given the sense to which, and apparently President Obama was concerned that this may happen, do you think that possibility is off the table?
The possibility of an invasion, Ian?
Yes.
I think the possibility of an invasion is very much on the table. In fact, I'd go a little further than that. Russia, in a sense, has already invaded Ukraine. First of all, they invaded Ukraine for purposes of bringing Crimea, which was granted to Ukraine 60 years ago, back into the Russian Federation. And second, you remember how there were all these characters, many of them with masks and no insignia, in Ukraine before the annexation of Crimea. There are characters of that sort in eastern Ukraine, which is dominated by the Russian-speaking population there, and there are lots and lots of assets in the form of agents, sleeper cells, that kind of thing. Russia is doing everything it can every single day to destabilize Ukraine. So it's true that the tanks haven't crossed the border, but Russia is interfering big time in Ukraine right now. And I'm certain that one of the many ways in which Putin is going to try to get the result he wants, and we'll talk about that in a minute, out of these negotiations, is to put this kind of pressure on Ukraine and indeed on the West, which doesn't want to see an escalation in the crisis.
So we know what the stick is, then what's the carrot here? I mean, I don't, in terms of what Putin is offering, there's no inducement on the part of the Ukrainians. I mean, my understanding is that, I don't know what kind of advice Putin's getting, but the Ukrainian people, and apparently this is a false distinction, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, because most people do speak Russian, that they don't want an invasion, they don't want bloodshed, and to a large extent, I believe, the Russian people don't want it, although they are sort of, you know, fairly giddy at the moment with the sense of humiliation having been lifted by this so-called victory in Crimea.
Well, you put the matter very, very well. I don't think there's not much of a carrot that's being offered. And by the way, if the Russians were to actually commit an act of intervention with armed force, I have very little doubt. I've talked to Ukrainians and I've talked to people who have just come back from Ukraine that they would find themselves in a shooting war with terrible bloodshed. And that can't be good for anybody. So that's kind of, I guess you could say, I wouldn't call it a carrot. It is something to give the Russians pause. And then there's also the stick that the West has, which is the reasonably well-coordinated and developing escalatory ladder of sanctions to be put on the circle around Putin, on Putin's bank, and perhaps taking the sanctions further, as well as isolating him diplomatically.
So what is then the issue over Transnistria that the Russians have raised apparently in Lavrov's speech before to Russian television before going into this meeting with Kerry and presumably in the meeting with Kerry? What are they talking about in terms of Transnistria, which is often described as the next flashpoint? It is a Russian enclave carved out of Moldova, but it's landlocked by Ukraine. So what do you think the Russians are demanding there?
Well, you've done a very good job of giving your listeners a quick crash course on a piece of land that not too many Americans had heard of until recently. But Transnistria is exactly what you say. It is the next flashpoint. It bears some resemblance to Crimea in that it's an enclave in what is also supposed to be an independent and sovereign state, a former constituent republic of the USSR called Moldova, and the Dniester River runs through it. And on the northeastern bank of that river, there's an overwhelming Russian population for all kinds of complicated historical reasons, whereas the people on the other side of the river are ethnically and linguistically close to the Romanians. And Russia has had virtual control, although not juridical control, under international law over Transnistria. That is to say, the Russian, where the Russian language population of Moldova lives for a long time. And in fact, that problem has festered as a so-called frozen conflict since even before the end of the Soviet Union. But those Russian troops, first of all, are within easy reach of Odessa, which is a very important port on the Black Sea in Ukraine. And if Russia was looking for a pretext to not only annex Transnistria and attach it to Russia, just as it's already done with Crimea, it might also use the several thousand Russian troops who are in Transnistria to move in on Odessa if, contrary to these promises that Lavrov has made, that there is no intention of invading invading Ukraine, which has to be taken with a grain of salt, that would be a very useful instrument for Russia to do so.
Again, I'm speaking with Strobe Talbott, who's the president of the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. So Andrew Cutchins, who's director of the Russian and Eurasian program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., has an article at CNN, "Does Obama Really Understand Putin?" in which he argues that the administration was not prepared that Putin would act so brazenly and that Putin was surprised at how weak Obama's response has been. What's your sense of how President Obama has handled this situation?
I have a lot of respect for Andy Hutchins. He's been a colleague for a long time. I don't see it quite the same way that he does. Not only was everybody in the West surprised at what Putin did with regard to Crimea in the immediate aftermath of the Sochi Olympics, I think Putin himself was surprised. In other words, this was not some longstanding strategy that Putin had. Putin, as Chancellor Merkel of Germany told President Obama after she had a conversation with Putin, Putin is not entirely tethered to reality. He tends to believe with conviction the most fictitious possible conspiracy theories, and he also has much more confidence in his control over a situation than he thinks. He was absolutely dumbfounded by the eruption of people power in Ukraine that swept the dictator Yanukovych out of office, Yanukovych being, in effect, Putin's guy in Ukraine. And he's been kind of making this up as it goes along. So, sure, President Obama was surprised. So was everybody else. And one reason that they were surprised is because we're dealing with somebody who is reckless and improvisational and who believes what are patently false theories about what's going on. That's a pretty dangerous combination.
Well, your colleague at Brookings, Fiona Hill, has written a book along with Clifford Gaddy, The Operative in the Kremlin, which and Cutchins also makes the point that Putin, as an intelligence operative, just quoting here, virtually abandoned by what he and his brethren view as an incompetent Soviet leadership with the collapse. And the ethos of the Russian intelligence officer going back to the foundation of the secret police in the early 19th century centers on their special, almost messianic obligation to save Russia from itself, a task only they were adequately trained for. So is that Putin's mindset in this? Because apparently he didn't talk to the businessman or perhaps even to his own generals when he made this decision.
Yeah, I think Fiona and Cliff, my two colleagues at Brookings, in their book Mr. Putin, have it right. But let's drill down a little further into the irony here, Ian. Yes, just as you said, Putin reviles and wants to reverse the basic premise of what Russian policy was, not just since the end of the Soviet Union when President Yeltsin became the president of post-Soviet Russia. But it really goes back into the Gorbachev period when Gorbachev began to give up reliance on brute force and give up on the big lie, and it introduced perestroika and glasnost and partnership with the West. That was almost a 25-year period where Russia made a break from its own totalitarian past in terms of its internal structure and its confrontational sort of permanent war by other means approach to the outside world. And that was a good thing for Russia. It was a good thing for the rest of the world. And Putin has decided it wasn't a good thing for Russia. And he's going to take Russia back to something that approximates those policies and mindsets that got the Soviet Union into so much trouble and caused it to break up. And the irony here is that you and I would not be talking today about a man named Vladimir Putin. We would have never heard of him had it not been that Boris Yeltsin, who really put those reform policies in place, handpicked Putin to be his successor.
And apparently regretted that at the end, thought it was the worst mistake he ever made, at least.
Well, I never heard. I don't know that he ever went that far. I was with President Clinton in May of 2000 when he, President Clinton, had his summit meeting with then-President Putin, who had just recently taken over from Boris Yeltsin. President Clinton had some deep misgivings from to what he saw, as it were, read in his eyes and heard from his mouth what kind of leader Putin was going to be. And then he went out to former President Yeltsin's dacha and told Boris Yeltsin that, you know, Boris, I'm not sure that this guy that you picked to succeed you has democracy in his heart. That was the way he put it. And Yeltsin looked a little chagrined at that. And boy, has it ever turned out to be true.
Well, of course, one of the reasons that Putin is riding high in the polls in Russia at the moment, with I think 80% approval rating, Sturm Talbot, is that what he's tapping into, this sense of humiliation, which has been assuaged by this kind of jingoism and a sense of almost geopolitical macho that's going on there, is because he's tapping into something real. You know, the Russians do feel humiliated, and the encroachment of NATO heading east is something that really bothers him. I think Putin knows what he's doing when he taps into that.
You're right up to a point, which is to say there is a widespread sense in Russia that Russia has been pushed around throughout its history, by the way. It didn't start with the end of the Soviet Union. But one thing that has changed about Russia is that while it has an extraordinarily powerful autocrat at the top running the show, in fact, I would argue that Putin has more personal power than any Kremlin leader since Joseph Stalin. I mean, even back in the days of Brezhnev had to go to the Politburo to get approval for something of this kind, such as getting approval to go into Afghanistan. Then that didn't turn out so well. But let's not forget that Russia has come a long way. We're not back into the Cold War. We're not back into a Soviet totalitarian state. And there is an incipient civil society, a degree of pluralism, which Putin has tried to rein in. But I think what we're seeing is kind of the first flush of patriotic pride that Crimea has been brought back into Russia. But a lot of Russians, and they're out on the streets on some occasions. There are even voices in the parliament there saying, "We're not sure that this was a terrific idea." And over time, since Russia is now to a degree integrated into the international economy, and a lot of Russians have bank accounts and have their kids in schools in England and take their vacations on the Riviera if we get into a continuation of the sanctions regime, which is going to happen if there aren't some real concessions on the part of the Russians, I don't think Putin will continue to enjoy that much support, including on the part of the rich businessmen, i.e., the oligarchs who are a very important constituency of his.
Well, just in closing, Strobe Talbot, let's just address what we know about what Lavrov said in Nisa on Russian television and what apparently he's talking to to Secretary of State Kerry about at the moment. And that is that he wants a new constitution for Ukraine that provides for a federal structure and that he's calling for neutrality. What do you think that means, and
Well, let me tell you exactly what it means, Ian. And what it means, if he can get it in the form he wants, is totally unacceptable. It means that Moscow wants to dictate to Ukraine the kind of governance system it has, and the one that the Russians want would give Russia even more power in Ukraine because it would be a so-called federation where the Russian-speaking parts of the country would more easily be able to resist policies from Kyiv because they would have the backing from Moscow. And if we're going to take seriously the proposition that Ukraine has been and should be an independent country, its form of government cannot be dictated from outside. But it's going to be up to the Ukrainians to decide whether they're going to have some form of federation. The Russians call themselves the Russian Federation, and they were federalized up until Putin began taking all the power back to Moscow. So Putin is in no position to lecture another country on having a genuine federation. As for neutrality, what the Russians want to do is rule out forever and forever and forever Ukraine being in NATO. Now, I think that issue is moot at the moment. It does not need to be argued. The Ukrainians themselves are saying they do not consider the issue of NATO membership on the table or on the agenda. Leave it that way. I think it would be a very, very big mistake to do what, for example, Henry Kissinger is publicly calling for, and that is to make assurances to Russia that Ukraine will never be in NATO, because the day may come when the circumstances will lead the Ukrainian people to both deserve and want to be in NATO, which is not the case now. So that will have to be resisted, or there will have to be some vague compromise that keeps open the option of what security structures the Ukrainians decide to have in the future, and whatever compromise comes out of these talks must also acknowledge and reinforce the sole right of the Ukrainian people and their government to pick their form of government that they're going to have.
But just in closing, though, if the elections go ahead as scheduled on May the 25th, then it's pretty clear that the Ukrainians want independence and sovereignty, and they're not happy about losing the Crimea. Will then what would Putin's next move be then? I mean, there's apparently a need for some kind of corridor from Russia into Crimea, short of having to build a bridge across the Kerch there. That's what's being discussed as a possible move in terms of that military force that he's massed on that border, and a land corridor down into Crimea.
Well, we're back into the very beginning of our conversation, which is exactly right. The right place for you to take us. We must take with a giant grain of salt, maybe a great big salt lick block of salt, what Sergei Lavrov has said by way of assurances that there will be no intervention. There's a sword of Damocles hanging over the Ukrainians, and it is meant to have exactly the kind of scenario you just described, have them worrying about that, and therefore prepared to make concessions, and also, because the West doesn't want an escalation of this either, to have us, the West, make concessions, and we're just going to have to resist that, because the costs of Russia yet again violating the territorial integrity of Ukraine, invading Ukraine, would bring us, I think, to the most serious crisis that certainly between the West and Moscow since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nobody wants that, and the Russians certainly don't want that. Or they, and we got to hope that that very powerful guy who's in the Kremlin, but who's also in a reality distortion field, is smart enough or comes under enough pressure not to make that mistake.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Strobe Talbott.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Strobe Talbott, who's president of the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Secretary of State in the Clinton administration, an expert on U.S. foreign policy with specialties on Europe, Russia, South Asia, and nuclear arms control. He's the author of the sixth Brookings essay, Monet's Brandy and Europe's Fate. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether or not the pot is calling the kettle black in terms of Russia's accusations about fascism and anti-Semites dominating Ukraine.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Rejuvenation, the second wind. When will it begin? Repatriation, what is my sin? When will my ship come in?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Beyond Détente, Soviet Foreign Policy and U.S. Options, Shockwaves, Eastern Europe After the Revolutions, and his latest, Crusade 2.0, The West's Resurgent War on Islam. He has an article at Foreign Policy in Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on the show, Ian.
And John, I was just speaking then with Strobe Talbott, and I must say it was a bit of a surprise to hear him say, since he's served under Bill Clinton and is a Democrat, he was critical of Henry Kissinger's advice, which is not to even to take off the table permanently any talk of Ukraine joining NATO. He felt that that was a mistake, that at some point in the future that option should be kept on the table. What's your...
Yes, I wasn't surprised. I mean, under Clinton, NATO expansion pursued very vigorously, and the Democrats were very much committed to pushing NATO as far east as possible. And although Strobe Talbott, of course, is very sensitive to, you know, the feelings and the perceptions of Russia, I think he also is very much committed to NATO as an institution that is as strong and as broadly pushed as possible. So Henry Kissinger, on the other hand, is simply looking at the geopolitics of the situation. He doesn't care so much whether NATO as an institution lives or dies in Ukraine. He's most interested in seeking some kind of amity between Washington and Moscow. So it's really a question of emphasis, I think.
So let's turn to your article, John Pfeffer, at Foreign Policy in Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. And I guess the first context is to point out that throughout the West in Europe, you've seen the resurgence of the new right now happening in France. You've got Jobbik in Hungary. In fact, the Hungarian government is dangerously moving in a very, very nasty right-wing direction. You've got Ataka in Bulgaria, Golden Dawn in Greece, and of course in Ukraine you've got Svoboda and the right sector. But you've also got bubbling beneath the surface some extremely ugly right-wing nationalism in Russia itself. So give us a comparison if you can.
Sure. Well, I think first it's important to point out that the right has surged throughout Europe and in the former Soviet Union, in part because of the discrediting of the left. And in the eastern part, of course, in Eastern Europe and in the former Soviet Union, left is often associated with communism and the failures of communism. And that created clearly a vacuum on the left side of the political spectrum, even when the communist parties renamed themselves social democratic parties and attempted to distance themselves from their communist past. In Western Europe, there was a push toward neoliberalism in the economic sphere, a push that even the left, even social democratic parties, embraced when they came to power, whether it was in France or the Third Way in England. And that, to a certain extent, discredited the left. So in this vacuum in which no party was really reaching out to the people who were most adversely affected by the economic transformations of the last 20 years, the right wing has moved right in there. You can kind of say it's similar to the Tea Party here in the United States, but in a much more aggressive and much more, frankly, racist way, these groups have identified minorities such as Roma or Jews as being the culprits behind the economic dislocation, and they have mobilized all of the people that have been left behind by political and economic transition over the last 20 years, and they have not been challenged by any major, credible, authentic, independent left, and so they have prospered. So I think that's what all of these right-wing groups that you mentioned, from Greece to France to Russia, that's the background that links them all together.
So in terms of the idea, as some who I've interviewed ever since this situation between Russia and Ukraine developed, a couple of people have said, you know, beware that what you wish for. As much as one can easily criticize Putin for being an authoritarian, having total power, being the new czar, being the capo di capo, the head of a mafia state, regulating the oligarchs, and perhaps shaking them down to the point where he may be one of the richest men in the world. And that Yanukovych, the guy that just got deposed in Ukraine, is a small fry compared to Putin. All of that notwithstanding, there is this cautionary note, which is that you could get worse than Putin if he were to invade Ukraine and turn bloody, and there was a backlash. What kind of government would likely to come to the fore? I'm told that it would be an ugly right-wing nationalist government. So what do you think?
Yes, well, I think that Putin in many ways has positioned himself to steal both the ideas and the thunder from the right, from the far right in Russia. And I'm be happy to talk a little bit more about that. But first, I wanted to distinguish what's taking place in Russia from what's taking place in Ukraine. Because there's been a lot of press about the rise of fascism in Ukraine, the incorporation of especially Svoboda into the government, the transitional government in Kiev, the threat that fascism will take over, really, in Ukraine. I think that, yes, right sector and Svoboda are very troubling phenomena. They're clearly far-right-wing, neo-fascist organizations. But they have, at the moment, limited appeal. They were able to gain their position in part because of the upheaval of the revolutionary or quasi-revolutionary situation in Ukraine, where they were willing to take risks that others weren't. They were willing to take a hard line where others were a little bit more diffident. And in that kind of a situation, they were able to propel themselves forward. Now, as we've seen with the Ukrainian government's killing of one of the leaders of right sector, that can be perceived as a threat, obviously, by the current government in Kiev, that this right sector is in fact a rogue element. But in any case, they have relatively little base in Ukraine. In the upcoming presidential election, it's estimated that the far right will get very few votes. And if there were a parliamentary election held, they too would get relatively little representation in parliament. In Russia, the situation is somewhat different. Of course, we're not in a revolutionary situation in Russia. We're not in a situation in which fringe elements can come forward and claim the political sphere, because essentially what we have is a far right that has grown in sophistication and in its kind of understanding of both global politics and Russian politics for the last 20 to 25 years. And instead of those figures taking over in Russia, they've in fact simply pulled Vladimir Putin to the right. They have influenced his politics in very important ways. For instance, one of the kind of key leaders in the neo-fascist movement in Russia today would be Vladimir Zhirinovsky. And Zhirinovsky is the head of a party he calls the Liberal Democratic Party. Of course, it's neither liberal nor democratic. He is often been considered the kind of clown prince of Russian politics because he makes such bold and, frankly, absurd proposals, such as retaking Alaska from the United States or surging south and retaking countries that were part of the Russian Empire in the 18th and 19th century, or giving away free alcohol. And yet he has managed to hold on to his political position, to in fact grow his political constituency in Russia. He is now a speaker of the Duma. He says things which continue to be radical, which continue to be perhaps the most kind of imperialist or expansionist in terms of Russian foreign policy. But whereas in the 1990s, his views were just outside the ballpark. Boris Yeltsin and the crowd around Boris Yeltsin certainly paid no attention to him whatsoever. But these days, his views begin to resonate at much higher levels of Russian governance, reaching even to Vladimir Putin himself.
Well, just in terms of the right sector and Svoboda in Ukraine, as you point out, that they have very little traction there and they won't do very well in the polls. They'll be in the low digits, certainly not in the double digits. But one of the problems that is with the current government is that there's a disproportionate number of them in the cabinet, which far outweighs their electoral appeal. So that's troubling. Now, maybe the fact that they shot one of the leaders, the government did, that might have sent them a message. But I don't understand why, given how much the Russians, Putin and Lavrov, are beating the drum on this idea that the Ukrainian government is all a bunch of neo-Nazis, fascists and anti-Semites, why the hell they don't purge these people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if I'd say it's certainly disproportionate to their support in the population as a
right,
whole.
Right.
It's probably not disproportionate to their representation in the actual Maidan movement, unfortunately. I mean, the
right.
Maidan movement was, you know, a very diverse group. It had people on the left, people in the center, and, of course, people on the far right as well. But again, you know, these guys were the shock troops. These were the ones who...
They took the casualties, right?
Weapons.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's, in some sense, why the government did this. They recognized that if they didn't do this, they would face opposition, not from a large number of people, but from a large militant number of people.
Right.
And this is a transition government. I think, you know, they gave them a couple of positions, frankly, which are not all that important. They have four, maybe five out of 19 or 20 positions in the government and the ministries. And with the resignation of the defense minister, that number drops. Another guy's like head of forestry or something. So it's not like they have an enormous amount of power. One fellow does, but since he's rather high up in the advisory council. But
on the National Security Council, right, yeah. The deputy head of the National Security Council.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But in general, I wouldn't say that they certainly are not pulling the strings. And I would also say that they don't have a great deal of support by the backers of Ukraine, either in EU or the United States. I mean, there have been all sorts of conspiracy theories put out there that somehow the United States government wants to see these right sector Svoboda people in charge of things in Ukraine today. And that's frankly absurd, because these guys, like the right wing throughout Europe, throughout the former Soviet Union, they are against European Union, which they see as a kind of bureaucracy that threatens to take away the sovereignty of their country. And they tend to be anti-American as well for a variety of reasons. But even without those particular ideologies, they're very unpredictable. And if there's one thing that Washington wants, it's predictability. And that's why they always choose, you know, guys who've studied in London or Washington, or are bankers or what have you. That's, to them, spells predictability, not these guys who, you know, carry guns and say all sorts of outlandish things about Ukrainian history and Jews and so forth.
Sure. Well, just in closing, though, John Pfeffer, in terms of the pot calling the kettle black and the extent to which there is a lot more anti-Semitism and neo-Nazi traction within Russia itself than there is in Ukraine, it's worth noting, when we're talking about the Ukrainian government makeup, that the deputy prime minister of Russia, Dmitry Rogozin, is way out there on the far right. So it's not like the Russian Duma doesn't have its right-wing representation.
That's correct. And, you know, it's important to look at policies, because, you know, what Russia is concerned about, what Russian nationalists are concerned about, are the lives of ethnic Russians in the so-called near abroad, in the neighboring countries to Russia. And for a certain class of far right, they definitely want to resurrect not so much the Soviet Union, because they have problems with the Soviet Union as an institution. They'd rather go a little further back in time and resurrect the Russian Empire. They want to not only ensure that the livelihoods of Russians in the near abroad, whether we're talking about Latvia or Kazakhstan, are secure, but that those territories themselves are locked much closer to Russia. And this kind of form, what I call a kind of extreme version of Eurasianism, which dates back to the 1920s, is an extraordinarily troubling phenomenon. There are moderate versions of Eurasianism, and there are some parts of Putin's foreign policy which highlight a kind of moderate Eurasianism, such as, you know, a much more voluntary association of Eurasian countries. But the Rogozins of Russia, the Zhirinovskis, have a much more extreme Russia-only white Slavic view of kind of pure space, animated by Russian nationalism and set up very strongly as an anti-European and anti-American bloc.
Well, John Pfeffer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Again, I've been speaking with John Pfeffer, who's the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Previously, he worked as an associate editor of World Policy Journal and has been an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. His books include Beyond Détente, Soviet Foreign Policy and U.S. Options, Shockwaves, Eastern Europe After the Revolutions, and his latest, Crusade 2.0, The West's Resurgent War on Islam. He has an article at Foreign Policy and Focus, Brown is the New Black in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and examining the emerging Republican strategy to limit Democratic votes in pivotal swing states in the upcoming midterm election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Hasson, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He is a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he is the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. His latest book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Hasson.
Always good to be with you.
And, Rick, it doesn't look like there's going to be so much an election meltdown in this upcoming midterm elections in November as hanging chads and et cetera. It looks like all of the devious, nasty, and underhand stuff is going to be done before the election.
Well, you know, I think we don't go through any national election these days where there's not at least one close race where things could go into overtime. And so, you know, we don't know if a meltdown would be coming, but because it's not a presidential election on the line, I think we worry about it a little less, although it is certainly possible that the Senate could be on the line. It could be very close there. But I do think you're right that much of the fighting over our elections these days takes place before we get to Election Day and takes place instead in terms of the rules for voter registration, which are very important in terms of who's going to actually be eligible to vote on Election Day.
And the lead article in Sunday's New York Times is New GOP Bid to Limit Voting in Swing States. It talks about these new bills, laws, and administrative rules in Ohio, Wisconsin, and North Carolina, which are aimed at suppressing the Democratic vote. There's also a possibility, of course, that they may inspire Democrats to turn out in November. How do you think it's going to break?
Well, you know, Democrats have a problem in midterm elections, regardless of what Republicans are doing, in terms of getting turnout up. They make a much greater effort in the presidential election years. And so already I expect, you know, we'll see relatively depressed turnout numbers among Democrats. And in part, that's also because Republicans are more energized. So it'll be very hard to know, even if turnout goes down, how much is it a result of anything done by Republican legislatures versus other factors that are independent of that.
Well, we know that there's a direct connection between the Supreme Court ruling on the 1965 Voting Rights Act of preclearance of southern states. When the Supreme Court lifted that ruling or lifted that requirement on the part of southern states, immediately thereafter, North Carolina passed the Republican-dominated government in North Carolina, state government in North Carolina, passed a whole bunch of measures which have been sharply reducing the voting days, establishing rules that make it more difficult for people to register to vote or cast provisional ballots or vote absentee. So there has been clear movement, at least in the state of North Carolina, in relation to that Supreme Court decision. Is there anything – I mean, there was some legislative attempt to fix that. Where does that stand?
Well, all right, so let's back up. There are two things going on. One is that since 2000, we've seen mostly Republican legislatures, to some extent Republican secretaries of state and other officials, creating rules that make it harder to register or to vote. You could think of voter ID laws, cutting back on early voting, making it harder to register to vote. So that was going on before the Supreme Court's decision in the Shelby County case last summer. What's happened since then is that those states that used to be subject to federal preclearance, and you mentioned most notably North Carolina, they were now freed and could pass new laws. North Carolina's law, much of it is on hold because it doesn't kick in until later elections. And there's going to be, in both Texas, which passed a tough voter ID law, in North Carolina, there are going to be trials on other whether these laws violate other provisions of the Voting Rights Act. And we're not going to get any ruling on those before the 2014 election, but we might get something before the 2016 election. I think other states are watching to see whether courts are going to block these new rules. And if they don't, then I expect we're going to see more Republican-dominated states passing laws that make it harder to register and to vote.
So is this just going to go on forever? I mean, we have the U.S. has the strangest voting system, and whether it goes back to the DNA of the founding fathers who only wanted white men of property to vote. No other democratic country that I can think of has such the business of registering to vote. Right next door in Mexico, people, when they turn 18, get a national card, like an ID card, and it proves who they are. And none of this nonsense about voter fraud, which apparently is minimal at best, ever comes up. So I thought after Florida there would be a real national debate to end all of this. I guess it goes back to the founding fathers who needed to get the 13 states aboard, so they gave them the rights to have conduct their own elections, and of course that trickles down to counties having their own laws. So you have this incredible hodgepodge of different rules. Is there any chance that there will be a national debate, or is there any way around this, what seems to be a sort of the most dysfunctional voting system in the world?
Well, I wouldn't say it's the most dysfunctional in the world, but I would say that among mature democracies, ours is the most decentralized and probably the least professional, in part because it is so decentralized. And there's a variety, a wide variety of approaches to how we run our elections, and that lack of uniformity itself sometimes creates problems. The Constitution divides power on elections between the states and the federal government. Since 2000, you'd think that we would move towards a more rational national system, but in fact things have moved in the opposite direction, and that modest attempts to make things more national have been fought back. So Congress created an advisory commission called the U.S. Election Assistance Commission, and it's become so mired in politics that it now has no commissioners because Republicans will not nominate anyone to serve on the commission, and they will not approve the Democratic nominees for the commission. In fact, in the last few weeks, things have gotten worse in this regard in terms of the centralization question, because a federal court in Kansas recently held that the federal government's going to have to allow states like Kansas and Arizona that want to check citizenship papers before they allow people to vote to the federal government on its uniform voter registration card, which anyone can fill out anywhere in the country to be registered to vote. They're going to have to ask for citizenship information for residents of these two states, and Alabama may now be joining along. So there's a clash now between the federal government's power to set the manner for federal and congressional elections and the state's power to set voter qualifications. And I expect we're going to see more litigation on this. And if it goes the way it went in the lower court, states will have even greater power to decide who gets to vote and what the rules are, even in federal elections.
So Richard Hasson, again, the Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine, and author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. Is there any possibility then, given the dubious chances of fixing this system that you've just pointed out, it's actually gone in the wrong direction since Florida 2000, which was certainly a wake-up call and an international embarrassment, frankly. What about the idea of shame, if you will? I can't think of a better word. I noticed that a Wisconsin Republican was appalled at the latest moves in Wisconsin to restrict the vote on the part of the Republican legislature and Governor Scott Walker. What about that idea of appealing to the idea of a level playing field, we are in a democracy and the vote is both a right and it's a precious right and people have fought and died for it? We keep hearing that in terms of all of the sacrifices and all of the wars, et cetera. And yet it seems to be there's no moral sanction against those who deliberately try to deny people the vote.
Well, you know, I do think that there may be a backlash, and you suggested this at the beginning of this discussion, that in some places, like Florida, for example, after the 2012 election, when people waited online for so long and Florida was once again a laughingstock when it comes to voting, that Florida put back in place the early voting it had rolled back. And in some places, like Wisconsin, Governor Scott Walker has not been willing to go as far as the Republican legislature in terms of cutbacks in early voting. He's allowed some cutbacks, but not total cutbacks. And so there may be something to this idea that at some point the public just thinks this is a transparent attempt to make it harder for people likely to vote Democratic to vote. The other place where we're seeing somewhat of a backlash is in the courts. And so in Wisconsin, even the Republican-dominated state Supreme Court is expected to strike down or perhaps limit the voter ID law that was passed in that state because it is too difficult for many people to get their IDs. And Walker is talking about holding a special session of the legislature to pass yet another voter ID law to try and fix the problems if the law gets struck down. So I think at some point, there may be diminishing returns to this. It does play to the Republican base, but I think for everyone else, it looks like a pretty transparent attempt to skew the electorate in Republicans' direction.
And in terms of the other part of your specialty, Rick Hassan, which is campaign finance regulation, clearly Harry Reid is worried that the Koch brothers are going to buy Republican control of the Senate, and they seem to determined to have Mitch McConnell as the new majority leader, and they are outspending and the various other groups. It's not all the Koch brothers, but all of these 501c4s that are out there are outspending the Democrats, and conversely, the Democrats are using the idea of a couple of billionaire brothers buying the next election as a kind of rallying cry. Who do you think is going to win? I mean, clearly the Republicans are going to win the money race, but who do you think is going to win the voting race as far as...
Well, there is no direct connection between the amount of money spent and electoral outcomes, right? We know you need enough money to get taken seriously, but I don't think it's going to be money that's going to necessarily determine the outcome of these races. I do think that Democrats have found that it polls well to have a villain, and the Koch brothers are a good villain compared to some of the other targets out there. But Democrats are facing electoral trouble, particularly in this cycle. They probably will do better in 2016. But Democrats are doing whatever they can to play off the Koch brothers to try and raise money to make it competitive in those races, especially in the South or in Alaska, where you don't expect the states to necessarily go Democratic, and you've got these Democratic senators that are, in some cases, just hanging on by a thread. So it certainly could go either way when it comes to control of the Senate in the next election.
Well, Richard Hassan, I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Hassan, who's a Chancellor's Professor of Law and Political Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's a nationally recognized expert in election law and campaign finance regulation and is co-author of a leading casebook on election law. He served as founding co-editor of the quarterly peer-reviewed publication Election Law Journal, and he's the author of more than 80 articles on election law issues published in numerous journals, including the Harvard Law Review, Stanford Law Review, and Supreme Court Review. He's also the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000. To the next election meltdown. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.